This is Robert Itis.
This is Hasina Kasem.
And this is Plants and Their Friends, a weekly show on WART 95.5. And this will be our first show, and it was going to be on cold and flu, something that is very up for a lot of people right now, and wondering what type of plants they can use because they don't want to use the pharmaceuticals. We have with us Nancy Odom. Odell, Nancy Odell, I'm sorry, and Mark Williams to talk about the plants that are in cold and flu and some other ones that we would recommend. Okay, so I'm going to turn this over to Nancy.
Thank you, Robert. I'm from here in Madison County. I've been here about 35 years trying to learn all the plants, but anyway, how I got into the flu and cold formula was with my mentor, Gilda Lee, who lived way up at the head of Grapevine Mountain. I started working for her as just a weed whacker to help her with her yard. And she was such a good herbalist, and she started training me in herbalism. I'm now involved with Heart of Herbs online program. I've been in it for 2 years. So anyway, she had a flu and cold formula that we started with about 18 years ago, and in it it had echinacea, osha root, and usnea. I know you're probably familiar with echinacea. I think the girl named
Hasina.
Hasina is going to speak about osha root later. And usnea, if you're not familiar with it, it's the gray lichen that you'll see hanging from almost anywhere in the world on trees that you can pick up off the ground. And it's one of the most powerful antibacterial, antiviral plants or lichens that you can pick up and drop in a jar of alcohol and tincture them off. Those are the three ingredients, echinacea, osha, and usnea. Then, a little bit later, Gilda and I started talking about we wanted to beef it up a little. And it just sort of came to both of us that we should add two more things. So we started adding elderberry and olive leaf tinctures. And that has been what we've been using now for about 6 years. My mentor passed away about a year ago now, and she bequeathed me her apothecary that was just full of wonderful things. She studied with Michael Moore out in Santa Fe after deciding to leave her marriage of 40 years, raising four children, having to deal with elderly parents, and at the same time she was working in medical offices supporting doctors and nurses, not as a practitioner, but as a just the person that you go to for everything in the office. So one day she left her husband, hopped in her Honda, and started heading west. I think the plants, the herbs, had already been talking to her, and she'd been asking questions, haven't been in the traditional or the conventional medical industry, wanting to explore plants. So as she was going out there, she kept stopping and having questions like, oh, what is that? And of course, she didn't have her phone, internet phone, at the moment, and had to wait till she got somewhere where she could look things up in libraries. This was many years ago. So anyway, she found herself meeting Michael Moore and enrolling in his school and becoming a certified herbalist there. And it's why I have a lot of southwestern herbs in my apothecary that I would not normally have. I was just talking to her, Hasina, about that. Osha root and yerba mansa, ocotillo. Did I say that word right?
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm just grateful for the opportunity that I have had to use and to get to know her herbs better. She also developed a flower essences that she makes with gemstones. And that came to her in a very strange way. She was at home one day thinking about flower essences, but didn't really know much about them. She went outside and saw a little violet in spring that was just blooming. And she said, "Oh, you're so beautiful." And all of a sudden, she heard the voice of something say, "You will take this little flower and you will put it in distilled water along with a purple amethyst stone and make the flower essences like this." She went, "Okay." It was one of those little demanding voices that, if you're familiar with Findhorn or any of the other communities or people that have worked with the plant devas before, know that they can be quite demanding. And she said that voice stopped her still with its sternness. Not too much later, she started having that experience with rose, rose quartz, and rose petals. And each of the seven flower essences that she makes corresponds to each chakra. And these work on a very subtle level and are very potent. So I still have all the ones that she's ever put together. I think we're going to turn over to...
Hi, everybody. We just had an interesting tour of some of the plants that are good for cold and flu, and I'm sure, as Nancy mentioned, some folks may already have a relationship with some of those. In particular, echinacea is probably one of the most famous herbals in the country. And I guess just different qualifiers come to mind with each one of those that was mentioned, and potentially some other plants come to mind as well. So qualifier wise with echinacea, my understanding, and we can maybe have a little bit more of a dialogue on this later, is that it's really better at the front end before you get sick to prevent you from getting sick than to be used when you are sick. I guess I would say in general too, something to be aware of is that it's very hard to deal with viruses. There's very little, as far as pharmaceuticals goes, in that regard. And in particular, it's good to understand that antibiotics only work against bacteria, pharmaceutical-grade antibiotics, not viruses. Most colds and flus are caused by viruses. Most viruses are also self-limiting, so that's something good to be aware of. And the point being is that just like with pharmaceuticals, also, to some degree with plants, it is very hard to deal with viruses versus bacteria. But of the plants that I'm familiar with that are known to be helpful with viruses, we were just talking about echinacea, but elderberry is, I would say, the top one amongst them. And there's a lot of great research that's been done on the efficacy of elderberry. And also it's just a very common plant. It's a very easy plant to grow, fairly easy to identify, and fairly easy to make medicine from. When you're talking about making medicine, there's a kind of stepwise progression one needs to be aware of. So the first thing is talking about, well, what are these plants, or what are these lichens or fungi? The next thing would be, what is it good for? We're talking about cold and flu, but there's a whole list of other things that you're going to want to take into account when you're thinking about actually bringing this knowledge into practice. And so with elderberry, for instance, you're going to want to be mainly using the fruits and making a syrup or a wine or vinegar or something that is capitalizing on the antiviral properties of those fruits. And to some degree, the flowers are used as well. Of course, if you pick the flowers, then you're sacrificing getting the fruits later. So you might want to do some of both, but definitely not all of the flowers.
I'd like to chime in here about elderberry coming from Stephen Foster and James Duke, who just passed recently. A warning, the bark, root, leaves, and unripe berries are toxic. So it's a plant that has medicine on one side and also has some toxicity on the other side. And as far as growing elderberry, you have to watch out, because if you're in an area where there's deer, they love it.
Okay. Yeah, so just like anything, the cultivation of plants is going to be having a lot of different qualifiers and details that you're going to want to pay attention to, just like with the making the medicine of them. This elderberry also wants to grow someplace that tends to be fairly wet, and especially if you're going to get flowers and fruit, a place that is at least somewhat sunny. But to get back to the medicine making, it's really the fruits that are the main thing, and there's lots of different products that you can make from those fruits, and there's lots of great science that's been done on the efficacy of those fruits in regards to fighting off viruses. Now, with some of the other ones mentioned, OSHA in particular, for instance, and when we're saying OSHA, I guess just to be clear, mostly talking about the genus Ligusticum in general when you're talking about OSHA, but really specifically the species Porteri, which grows in the Rockies. We do have a native species for the East Coast, Ligusticum canadense, but that's not very common. And there's a bunch of other species on the West Coast and up through Alaska, also not very common. So this gets into this other idea that also circles back around to echinacea, of the sustainability of this endeavor, right? And so there's definitely some question about the sustainability of harvesting OSHA, even the fairly common one, or at least the more common one, Ligusticum porteri. And United Plant Savers is an organization very near and dear to my heart, as well as Robert, and I imagine other folks listening. And so they've dedicated their whole organization towards maintaining these things, and they've got some really good information on OSHA. And I think that there's some due diligence that needs to be involved if you're going to take on working with that plant in particular, and really with all these plants in general, kind of following this path of cultivation as a form of preservation versus wildcrafting as something that could be helpful as well. Not to say that wildcrafting sustainably isn't possible, but it's just easy to overdo these things sometimes. And echinacea is another example, along with OSHA.
With echinacea, it is extremely easy to grow. It is a for beneficial insects, butterflies, bees. They love the cone flower. There is two types, and you don't want to mix the two up. There is a type out west, Augustifolia, which is usually not needing as much rain as we have here. So that is one consideration for the purple coneflower. And then the other one is the fact that when you harvest echinacea, you want to see those purple-pink roots of the second and third year. As soon as it hits into the fourth and fifth year, it starts to get very woody and the medicine is lost. Usually you can tell by looking at it, but if you want to make absolutely sure, if you take a piece of the root on your tongue, it'll have a distinct reaction and tingling, and you know that that's the medicine you want.
All right, so this is an interesting case in point, in that really important also to just understand that whenever you're listening to people present about information, they are presenting that information from their perspective, their knowledge that is just by definition going to be limited by it just being one person, and potentially contrary to other things you might hear from another person or from things online or reading in books. And an example would be, my understanding with echinacea is that you wait 4 years before you harvest it. So Robert and I can have a discussion after the radio show as far as where we got what from, and maybe survey some of our colleagues and see what we come up with as the prevailing wisdom on that. But also to say that, as well as angustifolia, the species that Robert mentioned, purpurea would be another major species used in medicine, but there are a number of other species of echinacea, like Echinacea pallida and Echinacea tennesseensis. And some of these are actually even very much more threatened than the more common ones. And sometimes you could be making a mistake because the flowers look very similar, although the leaves look rather different, and be harvesting a rare one when you're really looking for one of the more common ones. And these are the kind of things, when we're talking about ethical wildcrafting, that you really need to keep in mind.
There was a period of time when I grew tennesseensis, and it is absolutely beautiful, a dark-ish purple red that is quite a bit different from the more pinkish Echinacea purpurea. So I would encourage people, if you could find it, to grow it. It has been endangered, and it's Tennessee and North Carolina can grow the same plants, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. So just wanted to move on to some of the other different species that have been presented so far. And Usnea is a really interesting one, right, in that it's not really a plant. It's not really a fungi. The botany joke is that an algae and a fungus took a liking to each other. So it's basically some of both that have been blended together into one organism, or at least one physical form. And yeah, it's interesting because I've heard some debate on this complex of lichens, and there's even some other things that aren't lichens that look like lichens, and how to really get down to the brass tacks on which is which. And there are a number of different species of Usnea. There is some debate on the total efficacy across those species. Also, I guess just something to be aware of is that lichens are very intense beings. If you think about it, they are some of nature's recyclers, right, that are breaking down rock even sometimes. So they basically can have some very strong acids. Usnic acid, named after Usnea, is one of the primary antimicrobial compounds that is being taken advantage of in the employing of it for medicine. But at the same time, you really want to get your identification down because there's a lot of things that look similar, and there could be some other acids and other species that could be very damaging and deleterious to your health. And I guess another thing to think about with Usnea that we talked about some with the other plants, the method of preparation. And with Usnea in particular, though, compounds that you want are not very water-soluble. So it's really important to make a tincture if you really want it to be effective, to basically extract the medicinal properties of the Usnea into alcohol. Whereas with some things, like with the elderberry we talked about earlier, you could make a tea, you could make a jam, you could make a jelly, you can make all sorts of things and still get those beneficial properties. The Usnea, it's really alcohol extract. So just to kind of do a quick review of what we're talking about here. First, it's like, what are these things that can help with this issue, say cold and flu and viruses we're talking about? How do you go about getting them to help you? Well, you need to know what part to use. You need to know the method of preparation. Some other things we haven't talked about as much are the idea of any contraindications, like pregnancy, for instance, which contraindicates a lot of things, I believe Usnea included, OSHA included, and really, if you're pregnant, you really need to just like take a second look at everything under that specific lens, basically. And so thinking about contraindications, thinking about the dosage, both how much do you take at a time and how many times per day, and then for how long, because a lot of these things are very powerful, and you want to have as much of a dose that's effective, but not take any more than is required or necessary. And yeah, and so there's some other plants, basically, that we could maybe add to the palette now that we've covered those initial ones.
Right, and one of the ones that's dear to my heart is golden seal. And this is a plant that is not that hard to grow. It's a rhizome, and it can divide as well as have berries. So I would encourage anybody who would like to have or start a private, personal, medicinal herb garden to include golden seal. The root is traditionally used in a tea or tincture to treat inflamed mucous membranes of the mouth, throat, digestive system, also used for jaundice, bronchitis, and the tea is a folk remedy for eye infections. I'm going to turn it over to Mark to add some of the unique and very helpful attributes of golden seal.
All right. So, yeah, golden seal is certainly another really famous one that maybe a lot of people have heard about along the lines of echinacea. And at the same time, it's another one that is very threatened, I would say. And especially where we live in Western North Carolina, there's no way I would ever wildcraft golden seal. I've walked many, many, many miles in this area and seen very, very, very little golden seal in the wild. So this one really is one that if you really want to use it, needs to be cultivated. Ideally, unless you're maybe in some places in the Midwest, up in Ohio and places like that, I understand maybe it's a little bit more common. But yeah, golden seal is interesting that, as Robert said, it is unique in some ways. It also has a compound named after it, an alkaloid called hydrastine. Golden seal is Hydrastis canadensis. So hydrastine got its name from being named after the genus of golden seal. At the same time, golden seal, the name golden really comes from a compound known as berberine, which was named after another plant, berberis or barberry. And this gives us an opportunity to talk about the phenomenon of exotic invasive plants and also analogs. So there is a native barberry, Berberis canadensis, but there are a couple others, Berberis vulgaris and I guess it's Berberis japonica, that have been introduced and now run wild across the landscape. And as I mentioned, they share this similar compound, berberine, that makes the golden seal's root yellow, also makes the root of barberry yellow, also makes the root of Oregon grape, which is sometimes given its own genus, Mahonia, or is considered a berberis. It also makes that yellow. And there's some other plants as well that are named referring to that yellow color, like gold thread. The genus Coptis that grows further north, but all across the world in the northern areas. And then also locally, I would say our most common native one is yellow root, Xanthoriza simplicissima. What a name. So basically, there's some overlap in chemistry amongst all of these plants and a yellow coloration that is indicative of that. At the same time, they are going to vary in their levels of these berberine compounds. And Golden Seal is also special in that it has a very high amount of berberine. But at the same time, I would posit that using just more of some of these basically weedy plants that have less berberine, but then using just larger amounts of them might be a way to offset the pressure that is currently facing Golden Seal and being over-harvested within its native habitat. So this is always something to keep in mind, this idea of exotic invasive relatives of native medicinals, and basically trying to turn the problem of exotic invasives into a resource that we can use to affect good outcomes for health and various other things. And trying to think about how to be sustainable once again in all of our interactions with these different plants in whatever ways that we can be proactive in that regard.
Yes, there are opportunities locally to learn how to cultivate some of these plants. A little commercial scene for me is a workshop that I do twice a year in the spring. It is going to occur April 15th, tax day, on a Sunday. It's from 1 to 4. So if you would like to learn how to grow ginseng, golden seal, and a bunch of other plants, there's an opportunity here locally. People who have been supporting golden seal for cultivation goes back to the time of the Lloyd Library when the eclectics were in Cincinnati, and back in 1884, it was noted that if we don't start cultivating golden seal in a big way, we're going to lose this plant. And we are getting very close to that in many ways. But it's basically as a forest botanical to grow on the north-facing slope, it's not that hard. It likes to be grown right close to each other. Because it's antifungal, it doesn't have the problems that ginseng has. Being antifungal is a major aspect of its strength, along with antibacterial, antimicrobial. So these are some good goals right now to set up for your New Year resolution to plant some a garden, a medicinal garden, a north-facing forest garden to provide the medicinals that you need for your personal and family health. And if you're good at it, it could be a community resource.
All right. So speaking of resources, Robert already mentioned a really great field guide about Eastern medicinal plants by Stephen Foster and Jim Duke. And I would mention that a fairly new recent edition, the third edition, came out a couple years ago. So go ahead and get that newest edition that's been updated and revised if you don't have it already. Also, just can't say enough about the work of Dr. Duke in particular. And specifically, he has this incredible database online. You could Google Dr. James Duke database and that would come up, and you can basically put any plant that is something you're interested in there, and the compound. So for instance, the antiviral compounds will come up for that plant. They're known from the literature. This is something he worked on for a number of decades, first with the USDA and then after he retired until just recently before passing away. And also you could put in a compound. So if you knew of a certain antiviral compound that you're interested in sourcing, then the plants that are known from the research that contain that compound would come up. So that database is an incredible resource from Dr. Duke. Also, as far as books, if there was one book I would put out there, Medical Herbalism by David Hoffman, is a really good treatise that is used as a textbook for a lot of herb schools. And then up until a few decades ago, mushrooms were actually considered to be plants and treated at least alongside them. And there's a really good resource in regards to medicinal mushrooms, and some of those are antiviral as well, that was written by Robert Rogers. It's just called Medicinal Mushrooms. It's by Robert Rogers. He also talks about lichens like Usnea in there. And if I was to think of an organization that has lots of really cool webinars and other information online, as well as great conferences and a database of herbalist practitioners from around the country, that would be the American Herbalist Guild, which is actually based out of Asheville, North Carolina, very close to where we are doing this radio show right now. So there's lots of good information out there, and there's also lots of bad information out there. I think we all know, in particular, the vagaries of the internet at this point. And it's just something, I think, to not take lightly when you're delving into these waters. A lot of people can tend to think that you know, medicines of a natural derivation are somehow inherently safer, for instance, than pharmaceuticals. That is definitely not the case. There's plenty of plant medicines that can be very dangerous if not used appropriately, including some of these strong medicinals. So that's something to be aware of. And also, just as I've mentioned already, our impact on the plant and fungal populations that we are basing our formulas and our use off of. It's very important to think about. There is also the olive leaf, I know, that we didn't talk about too, so we might circle back around to that.
Yeah. This is Plants and Their Friends. This is Robert Itis and
Hasina Kasem
from Marshall, North Carolina, 95.5 on your FM dial, and we're going to continue our discussion on plants that can help in this cold and flu that's running around and affecting a lot of people. So be wary of it, because if it's not taken care of, it can lead to some major problems. Now, this specific flu, they're also talking about a number of cases of
pneumonia
that's happening, and we're all going to be talking. We talked a little bit about echinacea in this respect of taking it early. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a little while. I'm going to hand this over to my partner to talk about OSHA. She's come from the Southwest to Madison County, and she's worked with this plant out there.
Hi, thanks, Robert. OSHA is an amazing plant, and just as Mark was saying, we have to think about our relationship with the plants and our impact on the environment. OSHA is a plant that is very difficult to cultivate, so I believe that all of it is wildcrafted, and the elevation that it's found at is above 9,000 feet, and it's most common in Taos, New Mexico, or Taos County, New Mexico. It's also found in other Rocky Mountain states. It is a great plant. The root is used commonly, and it's great for an expectorant to clear the mucus. It can help increase blood circulation, causing dilation in the lungs to help us take deeper breaths. It's also been used in different cough drops and lozenges. And if you were to try to cultivate it, USDA growing zone 6 in moist, fertile soil, it prefers to grow into groups. Oh, interesting. It's in the parsley family. We just need to make sure, I guess, poison hemlock looks a lot like it. So if you were to harvest it, you just want to be careful about the populations. Its root has a brown on the outside and it's yellow on the inside. So that makes me wonder, as Mark was saying, if it has berberine in it. And I didn't use this plant a whole lot because of its endangered status. I really tried to focus on plants that were weeds, as we were talking about, and local plants. Algerita was there, and it was in the berberis family. It had a very yellow root, and it was very bitter, and I would drink it every morning knowing that the day would be better if you start off with a bitter tincture. And it worked. The days were pretty great there. but that's pretty much all I have to say about the OSHA root. Topically, it was applied to wounds to help reduce infection. It had different oils in it, phytosteroids, saponins in it. And but it's a very beautiful plant.
All right. So just wanted to tag in a little bit on OSHA since we're talking about that. And there is a professor out in Kansas, Kelly Kincher, who's done a lot of research about sustainable OSHA harvesting. One thing is that you can potentially pull the plant up, take part of the root, and then replace the plant back in the ground, and it will continue to grow. So that's one experiment that they're doing around that. Thinking about just how to make the most of something that is such a special medicine. And there are certainly some other techniques I've heard about with OSHA besides just making a tincture with alcohol. Some people have traditionally macerated it in honey and then used that honey. It is also another one that you could make a tea from. And the places that it is common, there are definitely some potential look-alike plants that could be very dangerous and damaging, like the poison hemlock, that you really would want to be aware of if you're gonna go into harvesting that for yourself.
I'd like to just say one little thing about this flu epidemic that's going around, and what we've kind of found out in my group that I'm studying with is that it is a cytokine storm. I'm hoping Mark can help me out with this. Can you, Mark?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay,
that does sound familiar.
Okay, so what pretty much happens is when your body starts producing so many white blood cells in a defense that it actually is what goes into pneumonia, and it's what's killing healthy people and children that normally don't have issues with their immune system. It's like your immune system goes into overdrive, and so in that, that's where we got into echinacea being, Mark said it should be at the front. Okay, good. It's going to prevent your colds, and it could prevent your flu. However, the question, and this is way up in the air still, and it's a theory that's going around with herbalists, lay off the echinacea if you think it's getting worse, if you think it's going into pneumonia, and up your antivirals, your antibacterials, golden seal, Oregon graperoot, usnea, but let the immune system just kind of back down a minute and let the antiviral and antibacterials and all these good guys take over. And then maybe, Mark, can you come in and say what I've been saying might make a little sense?
Oh, yeah, that's great. I really appreciate those qualifiers. And really a thing to think about with this, it is so complex and it can be a little bit overwhelming, I think, even for people that work with this sort of thing often, is that there's different ways that you can get to the same end, right? And so one thing is this idea of boosting your innate immune system to fight off the things for you. Another thing, when we're talking about these antivirals, like the Usnea, for instance, and others, it's going directly after the microbe and somehow disabling that microbe. And there are a bunch of different ways that have been studied as far as keeping the virus from attacking the cells, keeping the virus from being able to replicate itself. And then there's different stages of the replication process that can be disrupted. So different plants work in different ways. And then, of course, just like with pharmaceutical medicine, which often deals more with symptoms rather than necessarily a cure, as has already been mentioned, it's very hard to actively, quote unquote, cure or treat viruses, to destroy the virus itself. But there are things that can be helpful in addressing the symptoms of that virus while it's running its course. And so there are things that can help specifically with a fever, you know, to bring the fever down. There's things that could help specifically with the aches and pains part of it. There are things if there's a stomach component that can address specifically that. And so really... that's when you kind of get into this no silver bullet kind of thinking. And really, I think when we started off, that was addressed by Nancy and having a formula that is going to be going after something that you're dealing with versus just expecting one single thing to be able to do that. And that's certainly the way of traditional societies. There's typically not going to be any one silver bullet. It's going to be a formula that is going to get developed to address the constitution of that specific person, the issue that they're dealing with, the side effects, the symptoms, and everything in a holistic manner.
One of the things that Gilda Lee was pretty adamant about, when you took your cold and flu, you also took some vitamin C with it. And her recipe was every couple of hours you would take the tincture and then you would take some vitamin C with it. Some of these vitamins are pretty also important at this stage, so that you may want to also look into the minerals that are... may be deficient, so you may have some cramping and you may want to get some potassium or some calcium, magnesium. So you may have to take some other things while you're not feeling well to also bring you back to center. That's where we want to stay, is in the center.
Right. So... like the plants too, just making sure that we're clear, and that often in our society we can think if some's good, more is better. And in the case of vitamin C, my understanding is it's pretty hard to overdo the vitamin C. Basically, whatever your body can't use, it will excrete. But that doesn't necessarily go across the board for all vitamins, in particular fat-soluble vitamins. So vitamins A, D, E, and K, you very much can overdo. And if you take too much of those, they can really be an issue versus the vitamin C. So just not wanting to get too broad a brush on the vitamins. But certainly, the minerals that Robert mentioned are something else that can be in our arsenal, as it were, in trying to fight the sickness. And just to mention that there are things that you can take internally, but also things that you can do externally. And that came to mind with the minerals, like thinking about magnesium sulfate in particular, that a lot of people might know of as Epsom salts. Those are great to soak in when you have sore muscles, for instance. And also just making teas and plants that are like I'm talking like a whole body tea that you can soak in the bathtub can be a good thing. And also just wanting to really put a shout out for anti-inflammatories as well. And so that's why you'll often see something like ginger in some formulas, because that's a nice anti-inflammatory as well as immune boosting, as well as something that tastes good. And turmeric, which is related to ginger, would be another example. You also get into these ideas of the synergistic effects of certain plants working together. So, for instance, if you really want turmeric to be effective, what they found in India, one of the places where turmeric comes from, is that incorporating black pepper into a formula along with it will activate the turmeric more. So there's a lot of different little details here, and I know that that can potentially be overwhelming, but I do want to say that it's a really valuable exercise to kind of dig a little bit deeper with this stuff and kind of fully understand from kind of start to finish really how to affect the most positive change, both for your own health outcomes, but also for the sustainability of all these things at large.
Well, you are listening to Plants and Their Friends. We're going to probably run out of time pretty soon, but before we do that, I want to thank Nancy O'Dell from Coming Down, Sina, and Mark Williams for kicking off the very first show of Plants and Their Friends on WART 95.5 FM out of Marshall, North Carolina, in the caboose. So we want to thank you for listening. We still have to talk about a couple of other things, though. One of the things that we've slighted so far is olive leaf. You were going to talk about...
You want to talk about it? So we're just having a little bit of real-time dialogue on the olive leaf, and because I was mentioned as being in the cold and flu formula, that's one that I'm actually not quite as familiar with, but certainly my curiosity has piqued, and maybe we can circle back around on a future show and go a little bit deeper into that one.
Yeah, there are a number of areas here that we would like to, restate. We are talking about cold and flu. We're talking about getting into the plants that are antiviral, antibacterial, antifungal to help you over this period. Fighting viruses are very, very difficult. And we know that this last strain is a bad one. And we want to caution people from, if they're not getting better, not to continue with the echinacea, which may, we don't know, but there's some evidence out there that it may lead to pneumonia, which is something we don't want this plant to be known for. We do want the knowledge to go out that maybe after a while you stop taking this one and you take the other ones we've been talking about, the tincture of usnea, the golden seal in its many forms, and elderberry and osha. Those are some of the plants right now that we recommend people looking into very seriously. Any other comments?
Well, yeah, so... I just wanted to jump back in real quickly and say we didn't really kind of give a reference point from where I was coming from, but I'm the executive director of Plants and Healers International, and the website for that is plantandhealers.org. Also, I do an online botany class by donation in the tradition of Frank Cook at the website botanyeveryday.com. And so both of those websites are two venues that you can use to stay in touch with me. Email Mark, M-A-R-C, at botanyeveryday.com or Mark at plantandhealers.org.
Hi. Thanks for the websites, Mark. I just wanted to add a quick note about elderberry. It just happens to be one of my favorite plants. It grows very well. I'm a little disappointed to find out deer like it. We didn't have too many deer in Phoenix, in the Sonoran Desert area. But elderberry grows profusely. It sends up a lot of root suckers. You plant one, you're likely to have a lot more if the soil stays moist and it's in a good growing condition. The berries have a lot of anthocyanins in them. The berries are high in vitamin A and C. They also have potassium and phosphorus in them. Elderberry is something that we make every year, and we just put it in our tea every day. Like they were saying, the high amounts of vitamin C, you really can't take too much. And if you do reach a point that you're taking too much vitamin C, your body will let you know right away. And I just want to say thanks again. And
This is Nancy O'Dell again. My Facebook page is Geowild Apothecary. That's G-E-O-W-I-L-D. And you can look that up on Facebook, and I will be glad to help you with anything you need to know. Not anything. I don't know everything. None of us do. But if I have availability of an herb that I can help you with, just contact me through my Facebook page. My contact information is there. Thanks.
All right. So you might have just caught the train going by as Nancy was talking. Hopefully you could hear what she said. We are indeed in a caboose right next to the train tracks. Beautiful downtown Marshall. So glad we made it through most of the show without too much interruption in that regard.
And we also would like you to tune into a couple of other things. We're going to be this should be on at 7 o'clock on Monday nights. And we will be here for quite a while. We're going to make a couple, number of shows so that no matter what, they'll be able to be aired. The next show that we're going to talk about is if you take a hike in the walk in the woods right now, when it is, the sun is shining, what is it that you're going to see? And so that's going to be our second show. We want to make sure that everybody has set aside some time so that when they go hiking, there's a bunch of stuff that they may or may not know about that to look for that's out there right now. We also would like to indicate that there's an organic grower school, and we'll Eagle Feather Organic Farm will be out there with Red Moon Herbs in March, and we are still having some sprouted ginseng seeds that are available for a very small window from now to the beginning of March that need to get into the ground real fast. That will show up as plants in the spring, little seedlings. So if anybody's adventurous, that needs to be planted when the weather's warm and the ground is not frozen. But if you contact me at robert@ncgoldenseal.com, we can work something out. There's still a couple of minutes for us to, before we sign off, Mark, anything at the end of cold and flu?
Okay, well, I guess I would just speak a little bit more since we have a little bit more time about some accompanying plants that could be helpful. I sort of mentioned that before with certain symptoms. So, for instance, with pain relief, you have plants that have methyl salicylates or salicylic acid. So, it's kind of fascinatingly, is another compound named after another plant. So, the scientific name for willow is salix or salix. And so, salicylic acid, which is basically the chemistry behind the functioning of aspirin, was named after willow. And so there are different willow species that are used for pain relief. And then there are also these methyl salicylates I mentioned, which manifest with the smell and taste of wintergreen. And wintergreen is actually a plant. There's a plant named wintergreen, Gaultheria procumbens, from the heath family. But also this chemistry is in things like black birch and yellow birch, Betula linta and Betula alleghaniensis. And so making teas or tinctures from these different plants can be helpful for the pain part of the experience of being sick. And yeah, there are things that are helpful for sore throat. So using things that are mucilaginous, for instance, that are from the mallow family, like the famous marshmallow. That actually is a plant. It's not just a white smushy thing that you put in your s'mores. So marshmallow, but also related to that would be things like okra even, for instance. And Rose of Sharon is a type of hibiscus. It's also in this family. So lots of different things from that family are kind of slippery, slimy. Another thing would be slippery elm, exactly.
Slippery elm is a tree that grows here in our mountains.
Yeah, a native tree.
It's the inner bark that we use, and it definitely has that
mucilaginous kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, so really it can be, I think, compelling and naturally so to kind of just focus on, say, the flu or a cold and what's good for flu or a cold. And I would put in a plug for our colleague and friend Corey Pine Shane, who runs the Blue Ridge School of Herbal Medicine, because he actually just put a query out on the Facebook for everybody that wanted to give any input as far as what's good for cold and flu for a blog, an upcoming blog that he's going to be writing. So you might refer to him and see what he had distills from everybody's input. But the point is that, as I mentioned before, there's not going to be any one thing most likely that is going to be effective, and that you really want to think about it like putting a team or a band together that is going to fill the different gaps that are necessary. And as much as it's about what you want to bring in to help you overcome the sickness, it's also about what do you want to take out, right? And so a big way that we get sick, whether it's cold, flu, or anything, is from being stressed and overworked and underslept. And so the first best thing that you can do when you get sick is stop, right? To just stop working so hard, to stop stressing so much, and to start sleeping more and to start doing less. And really to work towards things like hydration as well, because oftentimes if we have a runny nose or a cough or something, then these are going to be liquids leaving that we need to replace, right?
This flu has been proven that only the shots are only 10% effective. The doctors think it's up to 40%, but it's not. I think this new stats show it's only 10% effective. They definitely don't have it right for this last one. And a fact of the matter is that it is born in the air, moved from one person to another person. And where has it affected me the most is people who have been traveling, who have been in a close environment, and everybody is not wearing masks, which is what they should be doing. And all you need is one cold there on your flight, and you have gotten it. Thank you so much, and we will be with you next week on Monday night from 7 to 8, Plants and Their Friends. Thank you all.